Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. Can the gospel of the universal church speak to different cultures? Sacred art, when Michelangelo depicted God the Father creating that first woman, Eve. Catholic authors, Muriel Spark, the woman who once wrote The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. I'd put the spotlight today on what might appear to us as a tricky equation. Faith and culture, in what, as the word Catholic indicates, is a universal church. Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, former official at the Pontifical Council for Culture, helps us better understand.
There's never been an attempt to equate faith and culture. For example, the Pontifical Council for Culture has a double mission, which is actually the mission of the Church as well, which is to inculturate the gospel and to evangelize cultures. And that's always very much a plural thing. There are many cultures, and the Church has to live in many cultures and become incarnate, if you like, in many cultures, take root in all those cultures. And the word Catholic means universal in the sense of embracing many different realities, not uniformizing them. It doesn't make them all the same. There's a great thing that happened to me as a priest in a very poor parish in an industrial town between Liverpool and Manchester. Half the parish was really, really poor, extremely poor, and many of the people there had never been to church for years. You could tell by when you had to do funerals, and many were in prison, many had been in prison. Really, a very unfortunate area and an unfortunate part of British society. But it was, so something very curious happened when I was doing funerals, especially for the most criminal families, as it happens. Very often the older people would say, "Father, can we have the Many Mansions reading?" And I had to think for a second or two, but luckily I have a long memory. And I remember that the older translation of the Gospel of John referred to Jesus saying to his disciples, "Don't worry, there are many mansions in my Father's house," meaning that in heaven there is place for many kinds of people, there is place for lots of people. Perhaps heaven may be the sort of place where you don't meet the people you don't like, but they're just round the corner and you don't know, so they don't annoy you to death. So you live happily ever after. I'm caricaturing that, but what I really take out of that gospel and the instinct of those people was, there's room for me too. In a society that had told them they didn't matter very much, they felt that for God they did matter. And I think that's very much the picture when we speak of different cultures in the world as regards the gospel and the work of evangelization. There is room for every culture. The Church has great difficulty in reaching certain cultures. For example, in Asia, a lot of bishops' conferences, when they came on their 5-yearly visits to the Pope, and also visited us in the Council for Culture, they gave us the clear message that they were regarded as a European import to their country and their culture. Well, actually, Christianity was born in Asia, I think. You know, some people have done their geography wrong. Although maybe what people meant was Christianity has become dominated by its European centre, either in Istanbul or Moscow or Rome. But I think What's important is that the gospel can speak to every culture. It doesn't make every culture the same, but it has a value for every culture, and that's the great challenge for the missionary and the evangelist. If we try to take our own culture with us when we bring the gospel, that's a big mistake. And that was already noticed by the official church in the 17th century. There are some remarkable documents from those days showing the awareness of some missionaries and some of the authorities in Rome that one must respect the people to whom one brings the gospel and not destroy what one finds, but see how to speak to them in their culture, to find ways of communicating the wonderful treasure that is in the gospel without doing violence to any culture. The past has enough examples of that. And from the 15th, 16th centuries on, I think there's been great wisdom in the church. Sometimes it's been forgotten, but it has been there and growing and is more a part of the scene now, where we try not to do down the culture to which we hope the gospel will speak, and sometimes even learn from those cultures new ways of expressing the gospel without changing the message. It's just a new way of communicating.
Many thanks there to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, who's currently working at the Council of European Bishops' Conferences. And now we focus on an example of culture focusing on the sacred, the artistic value of what no one would ever dare contest. It's the artwork of that great artist, Michelangelo, high on the walls of the Sistine Chapel. And as anticipated earlier on in the programme, his depiction of the creation of woman. So, Brita, today we're up to the ceiling again.
The creation of woman. Yes.
Eve looks like she's diving there, doesn't she?
Well, Michelangelo put a nicer landscape behind Eve than he did behind Adam. So, I mean, that satisfies me as a lady. So here you have this lovely blue sky at the back. And again, landscapes that look very much like Umbrian landscapes. Pale blue here in the middle. Blue just below for the water, I think. And then some rocks with sort of greeny, blue, brown, etc. And again, the famous, I call it the famous tree that seems to appear all over the Sistine Chapel. Just a simple tree. I mean, in terms of the work done by Michelangelo, obviously not the wall frescoes below, but this tree with sort of stumped branches, very little, very small tree, and just very minimal. Again, almost like a sculpture. Now, here you have Adam sleeping, lying up against this tree trunk, which is strange. And if you notice, his left arm is lying over the edge of one of the branches that were cut off from the tree. It's a very nice little trick that Michelangelo used to give the sense of total repose, total resting. No? And then Eve, instead of coming out of his rib, it seems like she's coming out of his back, actually, if you look at it there, you know. And one leg is clearly defined, and one part of our body is clearly defined as already created. You get the feeling that the other part is just forming as you look at it. One of the things about these creation Genesis scenes of Michelangelo is you always get the feeling that he captured what was happening in the moment while it was happening, not like before or after. You just get the feeling that it's all happening now and there. And again, this figure of God the Father, which is extraordinary, it takes up the entire height of this particular image. You see his head is there at the top and his feet right at the bottom. So it's a massive figure. I mean, his head is at the top of the sky and his feet are on the earth. So again, it's something that you would have seen very much in Gothic painting and also in Byzantine painting. But here, this figure, he has a red robe underneath and he has a violet type of cape. Sort of large cape put over his shoulders. And then his right hand is raised, a sense of benevolence and blessing, it's a strange kind of gesture. Because it's not like the gesture that he's using to try and give life to Adam. It's almost like he's pulling her out of the elements behind. And again, he's looking at her with with satisfaction. You see, you can see that he's happy doing what he's doing. His head is slightly bent forward. His hair is sort of yellowish and goldish. Whereas in the other scenes, you see God the Father with strong sort of grey, black, white hair. So here you have this feeling that he's enjoying the fact that he's creating what he's creating here. And then Eve herself has hair coloured quite similar actually to God the Father. You see sort of goldy, yellowish actually. She's moving towards him with her hands outstretched, waiting for, it's hard to know what she's waiting for. It could be it's waiting for permission, or it's a sense of wonder on her face that she's being permitted to be created. And of course, our Adam is in all of this is just sleeping like a log, right up against a log actually. the three faces here are very interesting. Here you have Adam looking towards the left-hand side with this total sleep and total oblivion. Then you have God the Father on the right, bending towards Eve with this expression of authority and pleasure at what he's doing. And then you have Eve, who is shocked, amazed, surprised. She's the figure here that seems to be most expressive. He creates his figures with a minimum of brushstrokes. He's not trying to do super definitions of all the figures, and yet you have the feeling that they're just going to walk out of that scene and just walk around the ceiling.
Thanks there then to Professor of Fine Arts Breda Ennis, who's currently working at the American University of Rome, for sharing with us her deep understanding and knowledge of sacred art. But stay tuned for another cultural programme in which Jill Bevilacqua brings us the writings of a famous woman writer. She's Muriel Spark, whose brilliant and original talent finds her at home in novels and short stories alike. Her non-fiction includes a tribute to Wordsworth, critical studies of Mary Shelley, Emily Bronte and John Masefield, and a presentation of the letters of Cardinal Newman. Apart from books of poetry, she has also written a book for children and a play, while one of her novels, The Ballad of Peckham Rye, won the Italia Prize for Radio Drama in 1962. Muriel Spark was born in Edinburgh and educated at the James Gillespie High School for Girls. And it is from her novel about an Edinburgh schoolmistress that Jill has chosen the readings which follow. The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie was adapted for the theatre and filmed in 1968. And the action takes place in a conventional type school to which Miss Brodie brings her decidedly unconventional ideas.
Marcia Blaine School for Girls was a day school, which had been partially endowed in the middle of the 19th century by the wealthy widow of an Edinburgh bookbinder. She had been an admirer of Garibaldi before she died. Her manly portrait hung in the great hall, and was honoured every Founder's Day by a bunch of hard-wearing flowers, such as chrysanthemums or dahlias. These were placed in a vase beneath the portrait, upon a lectern, which also held an open Bible, with the text underlined in red ink. Oh, where shall I find a virtuous woman? For her price is above rubies. Five girls formed the Brodie set. When they had moved from the junior to the senior school at the age of 12, they'd been immediately recognisable as Miss Brodie's pupils, being vastly informed on a lot of subjects irrelevant to the authorised curriculum, as the headmistress said, and useless to the school as a school. These girls were discovered to have heard of the Italian Renaissance painters, the advantages to the skin of cleansing cream and witch hazel over honest soap and water. They were aware of the existence of Einstein and the arguments of those who considered the Bible to be untrue, They knew the rudiments of astrology, but not the date of the Battle of Flodden or the capital of Finland. By the time they were 16, they remained unmistakably Brodie. "I should like you girls to come to supper tomorrow night," Miss Brodie said. "I have to consult you about a new plot which is afoot to force me to resign. Needless to say, I shall not resign." She spoke calmly, as she always did, in spite of her forceful words. "It's been suggested again that I should apply for a post at one of the progressive schools, where my methods would be more suited to the system than they are at Blaine. But I shall not apply for a post at a crank school. I shall remain at this education factory. There needs must be 11 in the lump. Give me a girl at an impressionable age, and she's mine for life." Miss Brodie forced her brown eyes to flash as a meaningful accompaniment to her quiet voice. She looked a mighty woman with her dark Roman profile in the sun. The Brodie set did not for a moment doubt that she would prevail. She would never resign. If the authorities wanted to get rid of her, she would have to be assassinated. "We shall discuss the persons who oppose me," said Miss Brodie, "but rest assured they shall not succeed. Not while I'm in my prime," she said. "These years are still the years of my prime. It's important to recognise the years of one's prime. Always remember that." 6 years previously, Miss Brodie had led her new class into the garden for a history lesson underneath the big elm. On the way through the school corridors, they passed the headmistress's study. The door was wide open. The room was empty. "Little girls," said Miss Brodie, "come and observe this." They clustered round the open door, while she pointed to a large poster pinned with drawing pins on the opposite wall within the room. It depicted a man's big face. Underneath were the words, "Safety First." "This is Stanley Baldwin, who got in as Prime Minister at the last election and got out again ere long," said Miss Brodie. "Miss McKay retains him on the wall because she believes in the slogan, Safety First. But safety does not come first. Goodness, truth, and beauty come first. Follow me." This was the first intimation to the girls of an odds between Miss Brodie and the rest of the teaching staff. Indeed, to some of them, it was the first time they'd realised it was possible for people glued together in grown-up authority to differ at all. Taking inward note of this, and with the exhilarating feeling of being in on the faint smell of row without being endangered by it, they followed dangerous Miss Brodie into the secure shade of the elm. "You girls," said Miss Brodie, "must learn to cultivate an expression of composure. It's one of the best assets of a woman, an expression of composure, come foul, come fair. Regard the Mona Lisa over yonder." All heads turned to look at the reproduction which Miss Brodie had brought back from her travels and pinned on the wall. Mona Lisa, in her prime, smiled in steady composure, even though she'd just come from the dentist and her lower jaw was swollen. "She is older than the rocks on which she sits. Would that I'd been given charge of you girls when you were 7. I sometimes fear it's too late now. If you'd been mine when you were 7, you would have been the creme de la creme. Sandy, come and read some stanzas and let us hear your vowel sounds." Sandy, being half English, made the most of her vowels. It was her only fame. Sometimes the girls would put a little spot of ink on a sleeve of their tussa silk blouses so that they might be sent to the science room in the senior school. There, a thrilling teacher, a Miss Lockhart, wearing a white overall, with her grey short hair set back in waves from a tanned and weathered golfer's face, would pour a small drop of white liquid from a large jar onto a piece of cotton wool. With this, she would dab the ink spot on the sleeve, silently holding the girl's arm, intently absorbed in the task. Sandy and Jenny got ink on their blouses at discreet intervals of 4 weeks, so that they could go and have their arms held by Miss Lockhart, who seemed to carry 6 inches of pure air around her person, wherever she moved in that strange-smelling room. This long room was her natural setting, and she had lost something of her quality when Sandy saw her walking from the school in her box-pleat tweeds over to her sports car, like an ordinary teacher. Miss Lockhart in the science room was to Sandy something apart, surrounded by 3 lanes of long benches, set out with jars half full of coloured crystals and powder and liquids, ochre and bronze and metal grey and cobalt blue, glass vessels of curious shapes, bulbous or with pipe-like stems. The older girls were standing in couples at the benches with gas jets burning before them. They held a glass tube full of green stuff in their hands and were dancing the tube in the flame, dozens of dancing green tubes and flames all along the benches. On that occasion, Sandy had the presence of mind to remember that her school days were supposed to be the happiest days of her life, and she took the compelling news back to Jenny that the senior school was going to be marvellous and Miss Lockhart was beautiful. "All the girls in the science room were doing just as they liked," said Sandy, "and that's what they were supposed to be doing." "We do a lot of what we like in Miss Brodie's class," Jenny said. "My mummy says Miss Brodie gives us too much freedom." "She's not supposed to give us freedom. She's supposed to give us lessons," said Sandy. "But the science class is supposed to be free. It's allowed." "Well, I like being in Miss Brodie's," Jenny said. "So do I," Sandy said. "She takes an interest in our general knowledge, my mother says." All the same, the visits to the science room were Sandy's most secret joy, and she calculated very carefully the intervals between one ink spot and another, so that there should be no suspicion on Miss Brodie's part that the spots were not an accident. Miss Lockhart would hold her arm and carefully dab the ink stain on her sleeve, while Sandy stood enthralled by the long room, which was this science teacher's rightful place, and by the lawful glamour of everything there. It was on the occasion when Rose Stanley, after the singing lesson, was sent to the science room to get ink off her blouse, that Miss Brodie told her class, "You must be more careful with your ink. I can't have my girls going up and down to the science room like this. We must keep our good name." She added, "Art is greater than science. Art comes first, and then science." The large map had been rolled down over the blackboard because they'd started the geography lesson. Miss Brodie turned with her pointer to show where Alaska lay, but she turned again to the class and said, "Art and religion first, then philosophy, lastly science. That is the order of the great subjects of life. That's their order of importance." It's time now to speak of the long walk through the old parts of Edinburgh, where Miss Brodie took her set, dressed in their deep violet coats and black velour hats with the green and white crest, one Friday in March, when the school's central heating system had broken down and everyone else had been muffled up and sent home. The wind blew from the icy Forth, and the sky was loaded with forthcoming snow. They were crossing the meadows, a gusty expanse of common land, glaring green under the snowy sky. Their destination was the old town, for Miss Brodie had said they should see where history had been lived, and their route had brought them to the Middle Meadow Walk. "We turn to the right," said Miss Brodie. They approached the old town, which none of the girls had properly seen before, because none of their parents was so historically minded as to be moved to conduct their young into the reeking network of slums which the old town constituted in those years. The Canongate, the Grass Market, the Lawn Market were names which betokened a misty region of crime and desperation. Lawn Market man jailed. Now they were in a great square, the Grass Market, with the castle, which was in any case everywhere, rearing between a big gap in the houses where the aristocracy used to live. It was Sandy's first experience of a foreign country, which intimates itself by its new smells and shapes and its new poor. A man sat on the icy cold pavement. He just sat. A crowd of children, some without shoes, were playing some fight game, and some boys shouted after Miss Brodie's violet-clad company with words that the girls had not heard before, but rightly understood to be obscene. Children and women with shawls came in and out of the dark closes. All the girls were holding hands while Miss Brodie talked of history. Into the high street, and "John Knox," said Miss Brodie, "was an embittered man. He could never be at ease with the gay French queen. We of Edinburgh owe a lot to the French. We are Europeans." The smell was amazingly terrible. In the middle of the road, farther up the high street, a crowd was gathered. "Walk past quietly," said Miss Brodie. In her middle age, when she was at last allowed all those visitors to the convent, a man said, "I must have been at school in Edinburgh at the same time as you, Sister Helena." Sandy, who was now some years Sister Helena of the Transfiguration, clutched the bars of the grill, as was her way, and peered at him through her little faint eyes. "Tell me, Sister Helena, what would you say was your greatest influence during the 30s? I mean, during your teens? Was it political? Personal? Was it Calvinism?" "Oh, no," said Sandy. "But there was a Miss Jean Brodie in her prime."
Our thanks there go once again to Jill Bevilacqua, who produced this programme and also read all the extracts from Muriel Spark's The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. To conclude today, I'd like to focus for a moment on a saint who is particularly dear to Pope Benedict, St. Bonaventure, by reading to you some words of historian John Moorman, which seem to capture the heart of Bonaventure of Bagnoregio, who, although extremely well-educated and zealous in his studies, never lost sense of being a friar minor, a lesser brother, a man of the gospel and a servant of humankind. St. Bonaventure was a man of deep humility, utterly lacking in the pride and arrogance which St. Francis expected to find in the scholar. Moreover, he was a mystic, a man of intense prayer, living in the closest fellowship with God and making large contributions to the treasury of devotional literature in which men have ever found delight. He was, as later generations called him, the seraphic doctor, the dedicated mind, a man who loved God with his intellect as well as with his heart and his soul, and worked only for the greater glory of God and the well-being of his church. You've been listening there to the words of historian John Moorman as he speaks to us of St. Bonaventure of Bagnoregio. That brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.